Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Bank.
You're fierce. You take care of business and don't hold back. Taking care of your health shouldn't be any different. You know when something's off. Don't ignore symptoms like fatigue, joint pain, and rashes. Listen to your body. It could be lupus. We're here to help you take control. Learn how at BeFierceTakeControl.org. Brought to you by the Lupus Foundation of America and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ruth Westheimer. And if you listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, you know that in most cases, size does not matter.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, this is Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and today I have Dean Shinas here to talk about freedom of speech on campus. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So free speech is a very broad topic you can probably talk about all day and all night. But specifically, I'm bringing you here because you've got a lot of expertise in dealing with it when it comes to college campuses. So what do you think makes the situation unique when it comes to this specific context?
Well, first let me say this is not my topic. My expertise is a faculty member. But interestingly, I've had to become knowledgeable about it because of being a dean and all the things that have come up since I'm a dean for 10 years. So, you know, the big topic is that in order to actually do research and educate students and have people learn, there has to be a freedom of expression so people can test out ideas, they can say things that other people might find offensive, et cetera, et cetera. And so for us to actually function in the way we need to as a university, we have to maintain a healthy respect for and support for freedom of expression on campus.
Can you start us off by giving us an example of a context where you've had to deal with threading that needle between being respectful, being a learning environment, and also letting people speak?
Sure. We've had a bunch of different really interesting events. But when I was early on in my deanship, one of my English professors came to me and said, can we do a year of events commemorating Karl Marx's 200th birthday? And I was like, sure. And we did that set of events, and then somebody did an article in the Trib that was critical of us covering Karl Marx and was picked up by some national media, and the trustees were unhappy, called our president, called our provost, called me, et cetera. And the president was very supportive in saying, look, this is academic freedom. We need to cover this. But it was extremely difficult to convince everybody that this is a crucial thing we have to maintain as a university if we're going to actually, even when they were very much against Marxism, the idea of Marxism, and took it to be a threat to the world in general.
So I feel like that also brings into play academic freedom, which is somewhat of a different thing than freedom of speech. How would you say the two interact?
Well, in freedom of speech, which is from our Constitution, this is a legal matter, and they've made lots of different decisions in the Supreme Court supporting it. And over time, it's become more and more clear that they're going to be extremely unrestrictive of freedom of speech. Hate speech is protected speech, weirdly enough, legally. And the reason is because you can't identify a set of words as hate speech without the context, making it really, really clear what's hate and what's not. And the example I'll give is all lives matter. Nobody would think those three words by themselves are really hateful speech. But in the context of when George Floyd was murdered and the fence was painted Black Lives Matter, and then someone came and crossed out black and put all lives matter became, I think, in many people's minds, an example of hate speech. And so I think that everybody in the legal system agrees that unless we can find a very, very clear definition of hate speech that we could apply in every context, then it's much, much better to not regulate it. On the academic side of the coin, in the academy, when research and education is the mission, there was, like many other institutions, no such thing as freedom of speech, because if you're in a company and you say something the company doesn't like, you can be fired, even though the Constitution protects your right to say it. It doesn't protect you from saying it for that company. So the academy had to actually add protections so that when you were working in the academy as a professor or a student, you had protections, that were at least more than you could actually ask in a company you worked for. And this all started in the very early 20th century when professors were routinely fired for their political views, their views that were critical of the campuses they worked on, etc. And the American Association for University Professors came up with not a union, but an organization that tried to encode what do we mean by academic freedom and what does it actually allow us to do. And so from about 1915 until now, there's been a very, very powerful movement to try to make sure the academy protects freedom of speech and freedom of research and freedom of expression much, much more robustly than companies do, for example. Now, public universities are required to follow the constitutional protection, but private universities like Carnegie Mellon are not. We choose to.
So specifically, you were talking about Karl Marx, and that was Kathy Newman, who we have had on the show about banned books. But what would you say makes a university follow free speech? Because, I mean, Dr. Newman made the point that the Constitution is very vague. It's Congress shall make no law.
Right. Well, I would say the legal system and the way it's been the way the Constitution has been interpreted by the legal system is robustly protective of free speech. That's not to say that you can say anything you want. You can't make threats, right? You can't harass. You can't actually do child pornography. You can't do obscenity in public. There's many, many ways your speech is restricted. And in particular, time and manner. So if you want to say something politically, you can't go into someone's neighborhood and just shout it with a megaphone at 2 in the morning when people are expecting to be sleeping, right? So there's lots of ways in which there's restrictions. But I think in the academy, when we're trying to have an environment in which people can explore potentially controversial ideas, transgender rights, abortion, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, et cetera, et cetera. We need an environment in which people can explore different perspectives, different opinions, different, ways of thinking about this thing freely so they can hear counterarguments and so they can learn. And so the other topic I wanted to make sure I get to is the difference between the kind of restrictions or non-restrictions we get from the law and from policies on campus and the kind of restrictions on speech from social norms, right? So many students will tell me that, if they're on social media or they're in a group of friends, there's things they don't say because they're afraid of being shamed or they're afraid that what they'll say is looking at weird, that's not the in-group's opinion, et cetera, et cetera. So in my view, that's a much more powerful influence on restricting and chilling your speech than any policy I as a dean will put forth or we as a university will put forth. Would you agree?
I think it depends, because there's definitely ways that universities can fully shut down speech. But also, I do agree that social norms are a very powerful motivator.
I mean, we found just by looking at some data, asking some surveys and questions, that the students feel very uncomfortable sharing controversial opinions, especially if they're conservative opinions, with their peers on campus, not just in class. And so I think for sure there's a pretty large social pressure that many students feel.
Yeah. So I feel like that also doesn't just apply to students, because I know professors and academics also have a bit of an issue with viewpoint diversity.
Absolutely. So if you're a professor in a class, right, there's so many ways you can step on a landmine and do something that's stupid, right? And in many of these situations, you're not trained. Right? You're trained in your subject. You're not trained on how to manage a class so that there's an appropriately respectful environment for a wide array of viewpoints. Nor are you trained to figure out how to run a class so that if there's a very small representation of a certain minority, you don't treat them in a disrespectful or harmful way. I've seen at least a dozen incidents where professors were not just accused, but put into a situation where something they did in class was questioned, and then their reaction to it was to say, I'm not going to do any of this ever again. I'm just going to talk about my subject down the road and then leave. So that's a really unfortunate chilling of what professors need to do as well.
Yeah, and also I think a thing about professors is that most of them, by far, are more on the liberal spectrum. So that's also a thing where you only get one perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that. And it's very, very difficult for professors to understand where the line is between challenging something they think is factually inaccurate, that something a person on the other side of the spectrum might say, or something that they just take to be sort of a misguided political perspective. And I think that I should also mention that academic freedom, as it's been understood, right, does not give professors, right, carte blanche to just weigh in on subjects that they don't really know. So if you're a physics professor and you just stop class in the middle of talking about neutrinos and say, I want to rant against Kamala Harris or rant against Donald Trump, that is not protected by academic freedom.
No. Well, if it's not your area of expertise, it's kind of a captive audience issue.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you have to be respectful of the fact that, you know, you might feel passionately about a subject and you might believe that you're opening the class up to discuss it in a very equal way. But there's a clear power imbalance, and the students have to know, or have to at least feel, that they're at risk of, if they say something that you find politically very, very untasteful, that their grade might be at risk as well. And I can't blame the students for feeling that. That makes perfect sense to me.
With, you know, the issue of students feeling afraid to challenge their professors or afraid to challenge the social norms of their friend groups, does CMU have any initiatives to try and counteract that?
Yes, we have several, and you were a part of one. So in the Dietrich College, we have a seminar program for first-year students called the Grand Challenge Seminar Program. We take topics that are challenging to the world: racism, climate change, food security, academic and freedom of expression. And we try to cover them from a multitude of disciplines. In the course of the Grand Challenge Seminar on Academic Freedom that I taught and that you were a student in, which was a great experience for me, we spent a lot of time in the beginning trying to get the environment of the class to be bought into the idea of respect. So we were very, very passionate about telling everybody that no matter what people say, no matter how offensive it might seem to you, we must be respectful and welcoming of all viewpoints, all perspectives. And it took a few weeks, but the students, I think, were incredibly good about buying into that and actually exhibiting that behavior. And then when October 7th happened and the attack on Israel from Hamas happened, we turned the syllabus around and we said, let's discuss this. Defense was posting messages that were very, very provocative and offensive to one group or the other. And then in the class, I think the students took what we had tried to set up and really used it and were incredibly civil and very constructive. And I think we learned a lot. I mean, I learned a lot about the intent, right, of Palestinian Alliance students when the messages came out that Jewish students might find offensive, and what the Jewish students were hearing, and vice versa. And so it felt like real learning was taking place in a classroom. So I think initiatives, what we want to do is make sure that as faculty, we can teach classes in which we do the kind of civil discourse. We model it, we teach it, we encourage it, and we can see progress happen when students actually get something big out of that. And as administrators, we can try to create events and try to create other things that go on the campus, like the Deeper Conversations series we had, in which we're willing to take on these controversial issues as opposed to just being silent about them. We're willing to have discussions, and the conditions are that the discussions have to be civil. I feel like this is an issue we've just started to take on, but this is like one of the big issues that the academy or the institutions of higher education in the U.S., they need to lean into. If we can't take this on and get faculty and students to have civil discussions, no matter how polarized they might start, who's going to do it?
I feel like freedom of speech is especially a big thing on CMU's campus right now because there are new restrictions in terms of assembly and protest. So a lot of students have been protesting that and kind of are really upset about it. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, that's unfortunate because I mean, I know from my side of the fence on the administration that was not the intent at all. So what's basically happened is when protests happen or when student expression on campus happens, with or without outside people, the university feels very responsible to make sure that's safe. And what we have experienced from last year is that some of the events get very passionate and some of the people who are coming in from the outside or even coming in from the students are passionate enough that where they're trying to provoke something that I wouldn't say is just violence, but provoke something that will break out into potential violence. The campus police tell us that if they have notice there's going to be some event, right, that's going to be sizable, then they're going to be much, much more able to protect the safety of the people involved in that event from people who came and were on counter protests to whomever. And so the idea of the policy for 25 people to register was simply to give us a better ability to keep these events safe, and that we have a complete commitment to the content of the protest. It has nothing to do with it. So if you're a group that's liberal and you register versus your group that's conservative to register, we don't care. The only thing motivating that is so we are better able to provide the security that we need to keep these things physically safe.
So as a reminder, this is Forbes Avenue. I'm Riota Duncan talking with Dean Shinas about free speech. So on that topic of the administration's view, you were part of the Commission on Academic Freedom and Free Speech. Can you tell me a little what it's like about being in that kind of room?
Yeah, that was fascinating. So the commission learned an awful lot about, you know, what are best practices, what's the history of this thing. We got some great speakers to come in, Keith Whittington from Princeton, Erwin Chemerinsky from Berkeley, other people too. And what I think we learned was that even though it's in many cases desirable to prevent people from doing events, having speech that is potentially offensive or hateful, that anything you might do to try to restrict that is probably worse in the long run than supporting the freedom of the students to hear all different kinds of perspectives, even if some people find some of them very offensive. Now, I say that, but in the room, in that committee, there were very clearly two sort of groups that evolved, and one group I would describe as more concerned with protecting, right, the environment from hateful, right, hateful speech or hateful groups or things like that. And another of the group, or the other side of the group, was more on my side, which is more supportive of free speech. I think both of us are passionately committed to the fact that we do not want a culture that's hateful or having things like that happen. But I think the approach that distinguishes us is, on my side of the fence, instead of doing it legally and with policies, let's try to do it culturally. Let's try to get the students, right, and the faculty and the staff, if there's someone coming in who's hateful, to push back on them. And so we need to protect the speech of the people pushing back on the haters as much as we need to protect the speech of the people who are potentially hateful. But on the other side of the fence, I think there are people who say that's not going to be good enough. There's still going to be people who are coming in and being anti-Semitic or, you know, very hostile to abortion rights or transgender rights or other things that are controversial. And that letting those people come to campus and speak, right, is creating an environment that's simply unsafe or unconducive to learning. So it was a tricky issue to try to figure out where we actually came down on. And so I think in the end we agreed that we'll modify our policy a touch, but that we were going to be robustly protective of freedom of expression in general. In the long run, we think that's a better strategy.
I forget who said this, but someone said that the best response to hate speech is more speech.
I agree with that. I mean, here's the thing. You might think that I'm an okay person, and I'm okay, well, maybe not, but you might think I'm okay. So if I have to make a judgment on whether something's hate speech, you might trust me to do that reasonably. But we know from history that if the deans and the provost and the president have the ability to shut down speech because they deem it hateful, then someone down the line is going to abuse that power. And then the people end up suffering the most from that ability of administrators to shut down speech are the people who need it the most. And so to sacrifice that people or those people in the future, right, in the present, giving us more power to sort of push back against what might be considered offensive and hateful, not to everybody, but to some, seems to me a bad trade-off. And I think that we have to be willing to be uncomfortable in many contexts in order to protect it, so that down the road, some administrator who's not well-intentioned is not able to shut down students who have a really good point to make or shut down protesters who have a good point to make. We have to hear it.
I was wondering what you thought of accountability mechanisms for free speech on campus or academic freedom, because for private universities like us. It's not that we're bound by Congress.
And I think we have to be clear in our policies to make that a value that we're actually putting out there as core value of the institution. So I think we did a great job on the Karl Marx thing. I think we did a great job on the Rick Grinnell, Ambassador Grinnell coming to campus. It was huge controversy over that. Many, many people wanted us to disallow it or fire him. We didn't. And I think there was a similar thing over Uju Anya and her critique of the Queen, right? Which was also, I think, highly controversial, but we stood up and we protected her ability to say that and Rick Grinnell's ability to say that and et cetera, et cetera. So I think the policy has to be clear and we have to actually walk the walk, not just talk the talk. We have to make it visible to people the positive side of it, right? And we have to make sure that people can have experiences in classes or in deeper conversations or in other places where they come out of it, right? They come through being offended. They come through being uncomfortable and learn something. So I just think we have to find ways to make it vivid and visible to our students and to our faculty that even though it might be uncomfortable, the positives are great.
So in terms of making it visible, how would you say Carnegie Mellon's been trying to do that?
Well, the two examples I gave, I'll go back to. One is the classes, and there's another class I'll point to called Dangerous Ideas, right, which Simon Cohen put forth, which explicitly took on the idea of very, very controversial topics and tried to get people to talk about them in productive ways, factually and otherwise. Danny Oppenheimer teaches a class called Human Stupidity and Human Intelligence, Thinking Online versus Thinking in Person. And in both cases, he takes on very controversial issues and tries to get the students to learn how to debate these issues, right, in ways that in the end will be much more helpful to them than just shutting each other down. And then the president and the deans, especially the dean of Hines and the dean of Dietrich, me, have made a pretty big commitment to these deeper conversations where we try to get the issues that are controversial of the day, the Israel-Hamas, Israel-Palestinian conflict, and now the election, the polarization that's a part of it, and lean in. Get it out there and try to create venues and events and forums in which people really can discuss these things and hear perspectives that are sufficiently diverse that they can learn. And I think in the deeper conversations last year, we were very nervous about it, but we had these discussion groups on this book called Contested Histories. We had about 10 people run discussion groups, and students, faculty, and staff were all invited to come in, and each one of them filled up. And by all reports, most of those conversations went very well. There were a couple of difficult issues that came up, as one would expect. But I think what came out of it was that we need to keep doing these things. So we're not afraid to talk about controversial topics. We invite the students to come talk about it. We get readings that actually matter. We get people to come lecture who are serious, who are not just provocateurs, right? These are all hard issues, or they wouldn't be controversial. So, I mean, I just think that we have not only a duty, but we've also seen that if we do it and we do it well, it works. And that's, to me, very exciting.
In terms of discussing controversial issues, what do you think about universities who put out, you know, statements about the hot topics of the day?
I mean, as a dean, I have been in several situations where, you know, people were pressing me and pressing the university to come out and say something in support of or in defense of or condemning. There's often a very, very strong number of people who can say, you need to condemn, right? And you're very conscious as a dean or a provost or a president that no matter what you say, you're going to, you know, make somebody angry. You know that, right? And you know also that you can't be just expressing what you believe because you're not speaking for yourself. You're speaking for the institution. And so that's inherently an impossible task and ridiculously complicated. And I think that more times than not, we get it wrong or we do more damage than we might have done by just staying silent. So I kind of believe that the default should be silence. We should not expect administrators, right, to take positions on social issues because that's not their job. Their job is to create an environment in which those issues can be explored, discussed, learned about, researched. But, right, not every issue can be, we can't be silent about every issue. And the example that everybody keeps coming back to argue against that with is, suppose you were an administrator in 1932, 1933 Germany, and the Nazis were taking over. I mean, you would not want to look back and say, I said, no, don't say anything. And the same thing, I think, about George Floyd. I mean, that was such a crystallizing moment in the struggles we've had with racism, you know, in our society, that for people to say nothing would have been inappropriate in a certain way. And yet, when we did come out with a statement, we got savaged from both sides, right? Some people say that statement's much too weak. And then some people said that's much too strong. So, you know, one tries to make it split down the middle to some extent. But I really feel like the amount of hours that administrators have taken over trying to get a message that they really think represents the institution appropriately, what its values are, and that addresses its constituencies in a way that they'll be able to hear as opposed to find offensive or objectionable, you would be stunned at. I'll just say that. And I don't really think that you want me, right, and the other administrators on campus spending a lot of our time and our emotional energy worrying about those kind of messages ad nauseum. We'd rather spend, I think you'd rather me spend my time worrying about, like, what kind of a great program can we put together, right, that brings together statistics in English, you know, for something like that. So neither extreme works. You can't weigh in on everything, and you can't weigh in on nothing. But I would much rather see the default be that nobody expects us to weigh in. Much, much cleaner that way.
So you were mentioning social media. How do you think that contributes to the whole situation on campus and in the world?
Let me go out on a limb here and say I deeply hate social media. I mean, I think so. We have had so many incidents where somebody had some reaction to something that got posted on social media. It blew up or ricocheted around and people, you know, got very upset about it before I even knew about it. You know, so it's the cycle of the social media explosion. It's not a week. It's not even a day. It's just an hour. And so, you know, you can't find the people that need to address it and answer it within an hour or within 2 hours every time. It's not practical. And there's been so many times where somebody has taken something and then gone with it on social media that in retrospect turns out to be not just false, but radically false or misleadingly false, right? And so you're in this trap where the speed of it and the way it amplifies and reaches so many people is so overwhelming and so much beyond our own capabilities, right? Even if I go onto social media and try to actually stop the bleeding or say something, right? You know, inevitably, the speed with which I have to do it, I'll make some mistake and say something that somebody finds ridiculously, and then that will be its own story. And so every time we've been in these situations, and we consider we need to respond to that. They're saying something we know to be false. Somebody else says, don't say anything. You'll just make it worse. You'll provide gas to the fire. And they're right. So as quickly as it blows up, it tends to die down. But I think in general, the social media that I've seen, it worsens the discourse in almost every way.
Social media is great at letting people speak, but it's not so great when it comes to amplifying, say, misinformation or dangerous lies or even just things out of context.
Correct. And it's also not so great at somehow creating an environment in which people feel entitled or safe to say truly horrible things, troll people, and use tones or use statements that they would never say face-to-face because they're just too offensive and they're too socially unacceptable. But in social media, there's no problem to say it. And I think that, so I think it brings out the worst in us in a certain way. And I think it's just for all the political issues of the day, made everybody's life more stressful, more anxious, and worse. Is that extreme enough, Abby?
Well, I think a lot of people have a complicated relationship with social media.
Oh, yes. And I know I'm extreme, but I'm old. I'm in a generation where, you know, we didn't do social media, right? You know, and I brought up three daughters, and I remember this vividly with this age where when they were, like, interacting with their friends. Sometimes they'd speak in person. Sometimes they'd call them on the phone. Sometimes they'd text them. And they would modulate what they did depending on how intense the interaction was maybe going to be, right? We never thought that. And so, you know, so I think the social media is just another outgrowth of that. It's a way to actually modulate how are you going to say something. But the way it gets amplified is just very unfortunate.
So if social media is part of the problem, what would you say is the solution to finding a good balance on this very thorny issue?
Well, I don't think you're going to stop social media. It's going to be what it is, and people are going to use it. And hopefully, over time, people will come to feel about social media that it's just sort of it's toxic, like, you know, like Twinkies are toxic, right? It's such a nice sugar high quickly, but if you keep eating Twinkies every day as your whole diet, you're going to feel like crap, right? And quick, and I think the same thing is true of social media. I think if you, if that's your main diet and you get addicted to it, it's just stressful. You feel anxious. You don't feel good. So I think hopefully if we provide better and more opportunities for people to interact in person and have discussions that they actually can enjoy, et cetera, and learn from, that they'll choose to do more of that and less of the social media. That's pretty optimistic and hopeful, but I'll stick with it.
Well, is there anything else you want to say before we run out of time?
I think that when I have had the experience of getting students and getting faculty into context in which they have enough time and they have enough safety to say what they actually think and to explore it, they behave well and they behave incredibly intelligently and they end up doing things and saying things that we all learn from. So I believe that I've already seen enough evidence to show that if we can create the context in which speech, right, can be free and productive, that is going to be a positive thing as opposed to a negative thing. So I'm encouraged, but I think it's going to take us an enormous amount of work to get there.
This has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I've been Riona Duncan, and my guest today has been Dean Shinas. Thank you.
Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hey, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue, where we are joined today by Annie Carnes, the Senior Marketing Communications and Development Manager of the Light of Life Rescue Mission. Thanks so much for joining us, Annie.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I was raised in the city of St. Louis, so I can remember all these urban development projects that would come along and things would be condemned by eminent domain and people would be moved out of their houses. And one of the results was homelessness.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of, at least since COVID and the pandemic, there's been a lot of movement around terms like urban redevelopment, eminent domain, and just in general, how it affects homelessness. Of course, we know that it causes displacement of our low-income, you know, residents in Pittsburgh. It causes gentrification issues due to the rent increasing. And the biggest one that we've seen is just, in general, the loss of affordable housing. You know, new developments tending to be, of course, higher costing, pricing out people that have been living in their neighborhoods for decades. So it's just overall increasing housing insecurity. And something that we talk about often at Light of Life are those just reasons why someone becomes homeless to begin with. You know, we serve over 3,000 unique individuals every year just through our emergency shelter, those that are experiencing homelessness, and all of them have unique stories. You know, some of them, their stories, you know, are an outcome of things like urban redevelopment. You know, they lost their homes because either the economy or these corporations or investors from other cities have found that Pittsburgh is also a good place to call home, you know, more of what Pittsburgh used to be considered an affordable city to live in is becoming less and less. One of the statistics that we use here at the Mission, we know that the city of Pittsburgh is lacking around 40,000 affordable homes for low-income individuals. The statistic is from the National Authority of Housing Coalition. There is an extreme lack of affordable housing for those that are considered low income renters. And, you know, it's kind of a new thing for Pittsburgh. You know, people tend to focus on cities like Sacramento or Denver, Washington, D.C., some of these larger cities that have always been known for affordable housing crisis.
But it's not just the housing. There are all sorts of issues that can lead someone to become unhoused or homeless.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, big ones that we mention, of course, mental health, which, it plays into those that have issues with addiction, and then addiction that plays into issues with people that have mental health. You know, they kind of play off one another. And those are two big ones. And the other one that sort of, you know, stemmed from the pandemic era were people that you know, lost their jobs during COVID, the economic factors and inflation that have happened over the last 4 years or so. Those are also two big ones, besides, you know, mental health and addiction issues. And then the other one is the affordable housing. So we talk often about those as specific reasons why people become homeless. But, you know, when you sit down and talk to some of the guests that come in and out of the shelter, they all have different stories, and sometimes they don't always align with those top three or four ones that I've just mentioned. Some of their stories would shock you, which is why we always say anybody can become homeless at any point in their lives. It just takes one significant event to happen in an individual's life. You know, your husband, who maybe he's the, you know, the breadwinner of the family, he has now gotten diagnosed with cancer. Your house catches on fire and now you're displaced. We also know the city of Pittsburgh sees 1,200 individuals were evicted from their homes in the month of January, which we know to have been one of the coldest months and the coldest winters that Pittsburgh has seen in over a decade. So imagine families, you know, not people who have just been displaced because of issues with mental health or addiction, they lost their homes, they were evicted. So that is averaging 40 families a night in the city of Pittsburgh who were evicted, some out on the streets in the bitter cold, others maybe couch surfing among family members. And it's, these are real numbers, you know, this is real life.
I've only lived in Pittsburgh for about 6 years. As I drive down Route 65 or get off 28 to go on the 31st Street Bridge, you always see these people standing there panhandling.
Yeah.
And I feel there, but for the grace of God, I could be there.
Yeah, listen, I'm glad you brought up the panhandling, because there's misconceptions, right? You know, people who work within the city limits of Pittsburgh, you know, not just out in the suburbs, maybe they live in the suburbs and they're crossing the 16th Street Bridge, they're getting up on 279, they're about to go through the Four Pit Tunnels. You know, there's people, there's panhandlers at each of these areas consistently, you know, during your daily commute. And I want to share two things. The first thing is, big question, what do you do if you come across someone panhandling? Do you give them money? Do you roll down your window? People have different opinions that can swing one way or the other. And something that we try to educate people on is, if you are approached by a panhandler, do not give them money. That could be the last $5 they ever spend. We hear stories about people who were given, you know, $5, $10, $1. And if they do have alcohol or drug issues, unfortunately, most of the time, that's what they're going to spend their money on. And the last thing that we want is another overdose. So what we suggest is, keep some bottles of water in your car in the summer. Keep some hand warmers in your car in the winter. We have something called Hope and Help cards that we have here at the Mission. People are more than welcome to stop by at our Ridge Recovery Place building and pick them up, you know, especially if you're kind of like a daily commuter. And what they are, they list our services, our meal times, more information about our shelter. We're trying to encourage more and more people that light of life. We're here to help. We exist. And those that are, you know, just out on their daily commute and they come across somebody and they feel pressured to give money, give them a granola bar instead. Hand them a Hope and Help card. The second thing that I wanted to mention was, for those that are passing the homeless, you know, that are visible out on the street or passing a panhandler. And, you know, for those that aren't familiar with just the homeless population in general, there may be some judgment or some bias. You know, oh, why doesn't that person just get a job? Or, you know, why doesn't that person just go to the shelter and get help? And one of the stories that puts things into perspective a little bit, that, not that we like to share it, but because it's so unfortunate and sad, it's just one of those things that makes you think differently. You may know, but Light of Life has a street outreach team, and our team goes out to different encampments around the city every single day. You know, we hit up different encampments throughout the week, and we try to bring them, those that are living in the tents or sleeping on porch stoops, resources. You know, we'll bring them hygiene kits, water. We will drive them back to the shelter so they can get a hot meal, a shower, learn more about what Light of Life offers to help them get off the street. And our street outreach team, there was a gentleman who was just sleeping a few doors down on the stoop of an abandoned building right next to our North Avenue shelter. And our outreach team would go to him almost every day, you know, hey, you know, can you come back? I think his name was Roger. Roger, you want to come back to get a meal? You want shelter? You know, we were offering as much as we possibly could to get him from, you know, keeping from sleeping on the stoop. And, you know, these people that are homeless, not only have they experienced some kind of trauma to get them there, but homelessness in general is so difficult. So they're experiencing even more trauma by sleeping out on the street, not knowing where their next meal is coming from, and then also being vulnerable to the drugs that are out there, and then, of course, harsh weather conditions. It's not like people are desiring always to be out there. So our outreach team would visit Roger to build up this relationship and rapport and just trust with him. It took about a year before this man decided to get up off the stoop and come into our North Avenue shelter for a meal. And that happens often. It takes a long time to build up trust because some of our homeless have just been burned in the past by trusting other people, organizations, or whatever their story is. And after our outreach team had built up that trust with him, you know, they had ased, do you mind telling us, how did you get here? You know, how did you get into your homeless situation? And, you know, we learned then that the real reason that Roger was not coming into our North Avenue shelter wasn't because he was refusing services. He had developed a mental health condition because of a life situation that he went through 3 years prior, where his house burned down and he was the only member of his family that survived.
Oh my God.
So his wife, his children, they perished in the fire, and his mental state basically had convinced him that he was unworthy of walking into another building because his family never had the option to walk out of one. And in his mind, he believed that he was no longer worthy of having a home, of accepting love, or walking into a building because he had developed a fear of walking out. You know, and so when you passed Roger on the street on your way home in your car, and you know, just a normal person, normal Pittsburgher, normal daily commuter, seeing him a few blocks away from a shelter, mind you, thinking that person just doesn't want to get a job. That person doesn't want any help. You know, this is the homeless cause this for themselves. They could get help. These are stories that we hear every day. And everyone's story, you know, is different, of course, but it really puts things into perspective when you meet people like Roger and you realize, and I turn it around to the people listening, what would you do? I mean, I don't know what I would do if I lost my kids and husband in a fire. I would go crazy. So you have to ask yourself, does that person have more to their story? And, you know, 99.9% of the time, that answer is yes.
We are talking with Annie Carnes of the Light of Life Rescue Mission. And I know that the Light of Life Rescue Mission and Northside Common Ministries and food banks, there are lots of agencies in Pittsburgh that are available to help those who are unhoused or homeless. Where are you actually located? What, you've got the mission on North Avenue, but that's got a special purpose, but I think you've got others as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, a little bit of background for those that may have never even heard of Light of Life Rescue Mission. We have been on the north side of Pittsburgh for over 70 years, serving the homeless and hurting on Pittsburgh's north side. And we started actually as a soup kitchen on the north side. Then they opened it up to emergency shelter for just men. After they had been basically saying, like, okay, let's get some long-term programming in here. So we went from soup kitchen to long-term programming for men, holding things like AA and NA, and then we opened up emergency shelter for men. But, you know, fast forward to today, We are actually no longer at the North Avenue shelter. As of last year, or the tail end of 2023, we opened up a brand new facility called Ridge Recovery Place. And it's on the north side. It was actually the old Allegheny High School vocational tech building next to the CCAC campus on the north side. Huge building. That is where we house all of our long-term programming for men, women, and children. And that's where our donation center is, where our administrative offices are. And that building is in addition to the emergency shelter that we opened up in 2021. Called Vetley Street Shelter, which is more on the north shore along River Avenue there. And that is where we have all of our emergency services, you know, hot meals for the homeless. People can come in and get resources, help with obtaining their IDs, which we know is a big barrier for people getting jobs and housing. So that houses all of our emergency services. Just recently, over the last few weeks, we announced that we have now officially partnered with another nonprofit called Off the Floor Pittsburgh. We have always been known for emergency services, you know, hot meals, hot showers, shelter, that sort of thing. And then we started getting into long-term programming years and years back, opened up long-term programming for women and children. But there's been this gap, or lack of focus, I guess is the best word, for people that are on the brink of homelessness. You know, these are the people that are just one paycheck away from losing their home. And they probably are considered in that eviction number that I mentioned earlier, that 1,200 people a month. And so Light of Life had started developing more services, such as our donation center, our food pantry. We have something called a free store. And these services are to help people either on the brink of homelessness so that they can focus on just paying their rent. You know, they don't have to worry about buying clothes for their kids because they can, you know, get it at the free store or the donation center. They don't have to worry about groceries because they can buy free food at the food pantry. They don't have to worry about buying groceries. And so one of the other gaps was furniture. Let's say you were homeless at one point and you went through our programs, or maybe you went through another program and now you're getting housing for the first time. You got to worry about furnishing your place, right? You don't want your kids sleeping on the floor. So that's where now we have a new ministry, or an additional ministry, I suppose, called Off the Floor Pittsburgh. So now we help people with furniture needs, which is really exciting.
In what you were saying, there are several really important pieces here. It's not just you're homeless, here's a bed to sleep in and a meal. It's also how can we help you find a home?
Right. And, you know, there's other agencies other than Light of Life. You know, we work with a lot of partners. You know, our donation center alone has 50 partnering organizations. So the people that they're serving can come in, you know, to our donation center and get clothing. And people in our food pantry, same thing. We've got 35, 40 partnering organizations for our food pantry. So now these organizations are coming in and getting food in bulk for the people that and the families that they serve. We all know that, you know, Department of Human Services for the county, they are the main sort of like entry point to get on the list for housing. They use something called Allegheny Link. Mm-hmm. And in our opinion, one of the gaps with the Allegheny Link system is you have to become homeless first before you get on that list. So, and, you know, if you are somebody who's on the brink of homelessness and you know, hey, you're getting evicted next month, it's harder to get housing. And the list is so long that those people that are waiting are the ones that are, you know, staying at Light of Life, Bethlehem Haven, or other, you know, partnering shelters that can give them temporary housing. And, you know, it just takes longer to get that housing that they need.
Now, I go to church on the north side and I ride the 16 bus into downtown. So I go down, you know, Brighton House Road, and there's Northside Common Ministries, and I walk past, you know, where your North Avenue mission used to be. I think it's really important for people to know that you're not the only place in town that's helping people.
Yeah. And we all talk to each other, you know, and we're getting better at talking to one another. You know, all these partnering agencies, especially during the harsh winter months, there's like a big email that goes out and basically says, here's all the open beds that, you know, we have open for the day. Here's all the open beds that the other person has open for the day. And
very good. Yeah.
And I think that that's super helpful, because what happens is, this is a big question we get, you know, it's 5 degrees outside and somebody walks into Light of Life shelter, let's say at midnight, they're looking for a place to stay. We, of course, have opened something called overflow shelter, because our normal emergency shelter is always full in the winter. And the last thing we want is to send somebody back out on the street, which we don't do. we really exhaust every effort to make sure that they get a bed to stay in somewhere. So, you know, if our shelter's full, we'll go ahead and call East End Cooperative Ministry, you know, say, hey, what's your bed situation look like right now? Now, luckily, the county's opened up the McNocker shelter for their winter plan, so that it's, you know, the ultimate low barrier shelter situation, just to make sure people are getting off the street during the winter. This year's communication amongst providers has improved drastically since last year. I will say that much. So I think it's just continuing that communication with each other. And then there's all these ideas that float around. Well, how can we make it better? How can we make sure that the homeless know where to go? And that's where street outreach teams come in. You know, we've got Light of Life street outreach team. And then, of course, Pittsburgh Mercy's Operation Safety Net, they have their street outreach team. There are multiple organizations that have teams that go out to the encampments and say, hey, you know, here's a list of places that you can go tonight. Do you need a ride there? So there are systems in place. I think that overall, anything and everything could always improve. And it's a matter of having those resources to have more people be going out and talking to the homeless within their encampments and their tents, and, you know, getting them either into a shelter, which sometimes they're hesitant on doing because they got to leave all their, you know, a lot of their stuff in their tents. They come back the next day, it's stolen, you know, everything's gone. So there are people that will choose to stay out in their tents instead of coming into a shelter for one reason or another. You got addiction issues, you got mental health. You have people who are staying in tents who believe that they don't need help at all because their mental health condition is so severe that it's really heartbreaking because you can't convince them that they need help. And, you know, we say it all the time at Light of Life, we need more supportive programming for people with severe mental health. You know, even you know, they'll walk into Light of Life, we will call Western Psych, and then they'll go to Western Psych, they'll get admitted, and then they get discharged in less than a day, and then they're back on the street. There is a huge mental health capacity. There's a gap there that we really need to start focusing on.
We're talking with Annie Carnes from the Light of Life Rescue Mission, one of the many agencies and shelters that is available to help the homeless here in Pittsburgh. A client comes in and needs a place to stay, needs food, and needs training, needs help with getting their act together enough to be able to deal with an apartment again. Mm-hmm. What are all the kinds of things that you do at Light of Life? Because I imagine that's very similar to what some of the other agencies do as well.
There's certainly a process. You know, you walk in, you seek help. And like I mentioned earlier, everyone's story is different, right? Like everybody has a different story and a unique situation that got them in that spot to begin with, which means, guess what? They're going to need a unique solution to right. help them and get them out of that. So we do an intake. We get to know their story. We have to understand where they came from. How long have they been homeless? Because we know if you've been homeless for, you know, 3 days versus 3 years, that's, you know, you get more trauma the longer right. that you're out there being homeless. So we do an intake. We understand and assess their needs. We have partnered with AHN and Northside Health, the mental health from the Northside. And they actually have staff on site every day, Light of Life. And if they have mental health issues or they need something other health related, we connect them with the counselors on site. We also have people who have jobs and they're homeless. They just can't make enough money to make ends meet to put, for instance, like a down payment on rent, or they may have like lost all their money through a divorce. Like you just don't know their situation, right? They're working. They're going to work and they're coming and they are sleeping at our shelter and going back to work. And a lot of the times there's that embarrassment that comes along with it where the people they work with have no idea that they're homeless and they're staying at our shelter. So we have a special designated program at Light of Life at the emergency shelter, as well as the long-term programs building. At the emergency shelter, we call it Shelter Plus. We have 12 beds for men who, for instance, have jobs and they're just staying at Light of Life. And then High Commitment Shelter, you know, you could stay with us, I think, up to a year for the High Commitment Shelter. We have finance classes for them as well so that they can learn to, you know, save their money appropriately so they can get out of their situation and get them back up on their feet. We also have a mental health program as well as a life recovery program. So if you're dealing with your mental health issues, there's a place for you at Ridge Recovery Place. If you have addiction issues, there's a place for you at Ridge Recovery Place. And then for women and children, same thing. We have a women and children's long-term program. You know, these programs can last up to 2 years or longer, where you live with us at Light of Life for that long. For women and children, the program looks different because they have different needs because children are involved. And oftentimes, women who have been through either the homeless system, the shelter system, have gone through addiction, they have either sort of severed the relationship with their children or, you know, it just doesn't look like a healthy situation. So as a part of their program, we help them get back on this sort of like family mentality and help them build back the relationship with their kids. And so the kids go through our program too, because that means that they're getting the support that they need as well. You know, we partner with the Homeless Children's Education Fund. They help with sort of making sure kids aren't falling behind on the school side if we have a woman in the program. So we have so many options. You know, our street outreach team, we have a day center. The outreach team members, not only do they go to the tents, but if somebody comes into the day center and they're like, hey, you know, I can't get a job. Okay, well, do you have an ID so you can apply for a job? Well, no. Okay, let's go to the DMV. We drive them to the DMV, the Social Security office. We get them their birth certificate. Any barrier that keeps this human being from getting back up on their feet, getting a job, getting housing. We have people that come in who just like, they want a job, they don't want to become homeless, and they're back up on their feet relatively quickly. And then we have people come in, they stay at our emergency shelter, and then finally they make the decision, I don't want to live like this anymore. I want to change my life. And then they go into our long-term programs, and then they graduate, and then they get into transitional housing and then permanent housing, and they become alumni. Some of them are now on staff at Light of Life, which is like the best ever because
they're role models.
Yes, exactly.
Annie Carnes is so glad that there are agencies like Light of Life Rescue Mission in Pittsburgh to help people. Now, I feel like Light of Life, Northside Common Ministries, all the other private rescue missions are filling in a gap that's not provided for by state, federal, or county government.
Yes. Yeah. Light of Life is funded primarily by private donors, you know, and we have such dedicated donors. And for us, you know, since we haven't been relying so heavily on government funding to do what we do, you know, we are one of the fortunate organizations that doesn't have to necessarily worry about us having to close our doors because we have such faithful donors, volunteers, you name it. And we couldn't do what we do without our volunteers. But it's a hard subject to talk about because unlike other cities, you know, nationwide, we truly believe that there is hope for Pittsburgh. We think we are a small enough city, even though the homeless situation has increased dramatically for the city of Pittsburgh over the last 5 years and it's become more visible. We still believe that this is fixable. You know, like we are small enough and we have so many great organizations and nonprofits. And for the most part, you know, a county and a city willing to start having these conversations with us as providers to come up with solutions, that we know that change is possible for our city. Our county here in Pittsburgh and our city, I feel like they're leaving all ideas on the table and they really are trying to find solutions that work, you know, and they could jump the gun and start building tiny homes, which we think isn't that great of an idea, not without wraparound services. But they're not doing that. They're listening to the providers. And we want to keep that conversation going. So I really think recently it has been, it's been more of a positive spin, let's just say that much, on how Pittsburgh can get out of this.
What can regular citizens do to help the homeless here in Pittsburgh?
You can educate yourself, truly, you know, on learning how someone becomes homeless to begin with, not passing that judgmental bias that you may have towards homeless people. I think that's a great start. You don't always understand people's stories or how they got there. And of course, I would be remiss without saying, donate to an organization like Light of Life or like another nonprofit that is directly serving the homeless and trying to get them help out of their situation. The other thing you could do is, you know, if you are someone who has more time than money, volunteer. Light of Life, we can't do anything. We can't do anything without our volunteers. They are truly the heart of the mission. And we have so many volunteers. I think we clocked in 16,000 volunteer hours last year. Yeah, so literally, we can't do what we do without our volunteers. Those are the biggest things, right? Just finding out where you can give back and how.
Annie Carnes, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us on Forbes Avenue.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Anytime that we can get to talk about the Pittsburgh homeless situation and educate people, we're all for it.
CT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you the best music.